This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The Nazi Holocaust ended with the liberation of the death camps by Allied soldiers at the end of World War II. That was a long time ago. But the hunt for the Nazis who participated in persecuting the Jews and others in those camps continues. Dr. Ephraim Zuroff has earned the title The Last Nazi Hunter for his dogged efforts to find the last remaining Nazi war criminals and the evidence needed to convict them. He has vowed not to let them die in peace because age has not diminished their guilt. Ephraim Zuroff is the director of the Simon Wiesenthal Center office in Jerusalem, where he coordinates Nazi war crimes research worldwide, and he joins us for the hour. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I should mention that he's here under the auspices of the Congregation Ora Tora and the Jewish Federation of Greater Charlotte. He also has several books to his credit, which we'll talk about as we go through the hour. You are a scholar of the Holocaust, work most of your adult life either for the Wiesenthal Center or on projects destined to be investigated or dedicated to investigating Nazi war crimes and criminals and apprehending these folks. But before we talk about your efforts, talk about Simon Wiesenthal. Who was he?
Simon Wiesenthal was a Polish Jew who was working as an architect in the city of Lviv, which before the war was Poland and today is the Ukraine. He was married, had no children at the time. And he was caught up in those events. He was incarcerated in, I think, five different concentration camps, had several close encounters with death, was almost murdered several times, either by the Ukrainians or by the Nazis, and ultimately found himself in the Mauthausen concentration camp in Austria, virtually on the verge of death, when the American troops liberated Mauthausen shortly before the end of World War II. And what's unique about Simon Wiesenthal was that instead of returning to his profession as an architect, he decided to devote his life to trying to find and help bring to justice the perpetrators of the Holocaust. And he was involved in many different cases and helped bring to justice some famous criminals. The most famous was, of course, Franz Stangl, the commandant of Treblinka, the infamous death camp, the person who built Sobibor, someone who was also involved in the euthanasia program of the Nazis, the mass murder of the chronically ill, handicapped, and mentally ill, and many others. And he basically became the personification of the effort to find these people. And in his case, it's especially interesting because unlike today when there's so much being written about the Holocaust and films and books, in the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s, there was very little mention of the Holocaust, and the Holocaust was a subject that most people preferred to ignore or to forget. And you could really say that Simon Wiesenthal's greatest contribution is not necessarily the Nazis that he brought to justice, but the fact that he helped keep the memory of the Holocaust alive during the years when no one or virtually no one was interested.
He was asked why he didn't pursue a regular career after the war, and he responded, "When we come to the other world and meet the millions of Jews who died in the camps and they ask us, 'What have you done?' there will be many answers. You will say, 'I became a jeweler.' Another will say, 'I smuggled coffee and American cigarettes.' Another one will say, 'I built houses.' But I will say, 'I did not forget you.' You did not live through the Holocaust. What's your motivation?"
That story, among other things, and I have to say that that story resonated with me in a very special way and is one of the reasons why I'm still doing what I do. And it was my encounter with Simon Wiesenthal, which was one of the reasons that I became actively involved in this, and also a whole set of circumstances.
Well, actually, I read that when you were 12 years old, your mother told you to sit in front of the television. This is an extraordinary thing for a mother to ask a child to do. But your mother told you to sit in front of the TV and watch the trial of Adolf Eichmann, which is one of the men that Simon Wiesenthal brought to justice.
He didn't bring him to justice, but he was looking for him for many years. Yeah.
So is that what really started you down this path, your fascination with this, or some passion that this stirred in you as a 12-year-old boy?
No, but that is the first time that I had any sort of meaningful encounter with the Holocaust. In other words, I'm actually named for my mother's uncle who was murdered in Lithuania during the Holocaust. But in our family, we didn't really talk about those events, and it wasn't really a subject of much discussion. The fact that my great uncle had been a brilliant Talmud scholar was much more important than his fate during the Holocaust. But that's not unusual, because in those years, in the 50s and 60s, when I was growing up in New York City, the Holocaust was really not a subject. No one, it wasn't taught in the schools. Mm-hmm. It wasn't discussed in our homes. My parents are American born, and they had no Holocaust stories to tell. So the Eichmann trial, was really something unusual. And my mother, who's really a very calm person and someone who doesn't get unnerved easily, was really in a, you know, state of tremendous excitement. And she said, listen, you've got to see this. You've got to sit down and watch this thing. This is happening in Jerusalem. Israel, young state of Israel, was able to find one of the architects of the mass murder of the Jewish people, and he's on trial in Jerusalem. And here it is on our TV.
And you watched.
And I watched. Right. I was riveted. I was riveted to the screen. But again, remember, I was a 12-year-old kid.
Sure.
And I barely knew what the Holocaust was.
Did people not talk about the Holocaust in the 50s and 60s? Because for the same reason that many men who came back from the war as soldiers didn't talk about what their experiences were in the war, because it was too horrific to contemplate in many cases?
I think that's certainly part of it. But as far as the Jewish community is concerned, there was a tremendous sense of failure. Hmm. And tremendous sense of guilt because of the failure of the Jewish communities around the world to do more to try and save their brethren from Europe. And this is a very, very painful issue, one which ultimately had a positive impact because it led to, I think, very activist campaigns on behalf of Soviet Jewry, for example, and other Jews in distress. And the words of never again were really, in a sense, a moral imperative, mm-hmm. in the wake of the failure during the Holocaust, which is, of course, one of the reasons why, as you correctly noted, in the years after the war, no one wanted to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Early in your efforts, you uncovered the post-war escape of hundreds of Nazi war criminals to places like Australia and Canada, Great Britain, other countries. That was in 1986, and it led to laws in those countries to enable the prosecution in those countries of Nazi war criminals. But it has now been 60 years, at least, since the end of the war. How many undiscovered Nazi war criminals are still with us?
A lot more than people think, and I'll tell you why. The Nazis, it wasn't only German and Austrian Nazis. It was Nazi collaborators in every single country in Europe, with the exception of the neutral countries. And that's only six countries. In other words, Turkey, Sweden, Switzerland, Ireland, Spain, Portugal. In every other country was either under Nazi occupation, mm-hmm. or allied with Nazi Germany. The Nazis tried very hard to enlist local helpers for ideological reasons and for practical reasons. The ideological reasons were they wanted to show that many people supported their plan against the Jews. The practical reasons were they were short on manpower. And, of course, if Jews were trying to hide, it was much easier to fool a German from Hamburg or an Austrian from Vienna than their neighbor down the street who could identify them as Jews. Mm-hmm. So the Nazis recruited millions of helpers. And some of these people were relatively young. And today, with the wonders of modern medicine, I sometimes half-jokingly say people without a conscience live longer. So many of them are alive and unprosecuted.
Hmm. You've said that you do this because you won't let them die in peace. I said that in the opening. And because age has not diminished their guilt. But some of them, even if they were young at the time of the war, they're still fairly elderly today. Were they 80, 90 years old?
Mid-80s, at least mid-80s.
So what makes for a just punishment for someone in their mid-80s to early 90s who were perpetrators of these crimes?
Well, first of all, to be exposed as such. And sometimes that's the most serious punishment.
Because they've gone on to lead, in many cases, exemplary lives as liars, essentially.
Right, exactly. And that to expose them, to expose what they did is a very important thing. But there's also the whole issue of justice in the sense that the government of the countries, either where they committed the crime or that sent them to commit the crime, are basically saying that the crimes of the Holocaust are so serious, are so terrible, that even many years later, there's value to bring these people to a trial and, if possible, if warranted, to punish them.
When you find these people, and you found many, and you continue to find them, are they remorseful? Do they repudiate what they did in their younger days?
That's a very, very important question. And it's a very sad phenomenon. But in all my 30 years of experience, in all the cases that I've personally dealt with, it's a couple dozen cases at least, I've never encountered a single Nazi war criminal who ever expressed any regret or remorse. Now, this is really strange, because if you think about it, a lot of these people live in countries where they talk about the Holocaust a lot. Mm-hmm. A lot of films, a lot of books, etc. And they might realize that this Holocaust that everyone's talking about is something that they were actually involved in. So they might they in theory could say to us, listen, we were brainwashed. We were young. Mm-hmm. We were stupid. We didn't know what we were doing. But they never say it. On the contrary, I've encountered cases. One of my most, I think, important cases was the case of the commandant of a camp named Jasenovac in Croatia, a camp where at least 90,000 civilians were murdered. And I helped track down one of the commandants of that camp, a man by the name of Dinko Šakić. And when he was first exposed by us, he said to the journalists asked him, how do you explain those terrible crimes? And Jasenovac was known as one of the most cruel in human places, a real hellhole. It was nicknamed the Auschwitz of the Balkans. So when the journalist asked Dinko Šakić, his name was, how do you explain the cruelty, the atrocities? He says, you don't understand. The problem with the Jasenovac was that they didn't let us finish the job.
Still, after all these years.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the proper punishment for somebody like that?
Imprisonment. I mean, in countries without a death penalty. I have no problem with the death penalty in these cases, but most countries today don't have death penalties. So.
As late as 1991, you discovered in Lithuania a program to rehabilitate Nazi war criminals, and you campaigned to stop the process of rehabilitation. What kind of program was it, and why would you want it stopped?
Okay. Lithuania was liberated or occupied, depending on your politics, by the Soviet Union in 1944. Mm-hmm. In other words, they defeated the Nazis, kicked them out of Lithuania, and that began the occupation, or the second occupation of Lithuania by the Soviets. And it was part of the Soviet Union until 1991. And it's true that during the period of the Soviet Union, a lot of Lithuanians were wrongly, unjustly prosecuted for political crimes by the communists. Mm-hmm. So the government in 1990 passed a law in allowing the rehabilitation of those individuals who were unjustly convicted and punished. And that program also included financial rewards. But what's interesting is this. The law specifically said that those who had participated in genocide were ineligible to be rehabilitated. Mm. But I was able to discover that dozens of these people who had murdered Jews and had been prosecuted by the communists, by the Soviet Union, for their role in the murder of civilians, were getting rehabilitations against the law itself. In other words, the law was okay, but the implementation of the law was deeply flawed.
Dr. Efraim Zuroff is with us. He's an Israeli historian, director of the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Jerusalem, coordinator of Nazi war crimes research, and the author of Operation Last Chance, One Man's Quest to Bring Nazi War Criminals to Justice. We will continue in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is made possible in part today by the German-American Chamber of Commerce 6th Annual Gateway Award Luncheon, honoring business relations between Germany and the United States, presented by Keith Crisco, Secretary of Commerce, May 27th at the Charlotte City Club. Well, it's almost summer. How do I know this, aside from the temperature? Well, because of the crop of summer movies that has already begun to hit the screens. Iron Man 2 and Robin Hood are joined by Shrek Forever After and MacGruber, which opened this past weekend. And some are waiting for Sex and the City 2. It's a time for action movies, a lot of frothy, light, let's get out of the heat films. And we will be joined tomorrow at 9 by Charlotte's movie critics to tell us if any of these films are any good. That's at 9 tomorrow on Charlotte Talk.
The creation of the world's first self-replicating synthetic cell heralds a new era in biology. It also prompts moral, legal, and safety questions. Analysis of the potential benefits and ethical concerns. The Diane Rehm Show, Monday.
The Diane Rehm Show, this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, here on 90.7 FM, WFAE, your NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Dr. Ephraim Zuroff, director of the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Jerusalem. Among his books, Operation Nazi Hunter, The Continuing Search for the Perpetrators of the Holocaust, and his latest, Operation Last Chance, One Man's Quest to Bring Nazi Criminals to Justice. He's here to speak tonight at 8 o'clock at the Jewish Community Center, and people are invited to that as well. Lithuania, we were talking about just before the break, a former Soviet bloc country. You launched something called Operation Last Chance, which I guess is what the book is about. It's a primarily work in the former Eastern Bloc nations, and you worked with those in Lithuania as well as Latvia, Poland, Romania, Estonia, and other nations to confront what you say is there widespread complicity in the crimes of the Holocaust, and also to prosecute local Nazi collaborators. Given the losses that the Soviet bloc nations suffered at the hands of the Germans, at the Nazis, in World War II, why would there be any reluctance to cooperate with you whatsoever?
I mean, First of all, because in those countries there was widespread collaboration with the Nazis in the mass murder of Jews. And the reasons are... There are many reasons why many Lithuanians collaborated with the Nazis. One was the issue of political opportunism. These countries had been independent from World War I until 1940 when they were occupied by the Soviets. Mm-hmm. And their hope was that the Germans would give them back independence. Now, the Germans had no such plans, but this was one of their hopes. And obviously, since this was a country which had a deep tradition of anti-Semitism, so this was obviously one of the areas where they could cooperate with the Germans and help the Germans. And this led to massive complicity, a complicity which was encompassed all strata of Lithuanian society, from the intelligentsia to the hooligans, so to speak. Now, today in Lithuania, they try very hard to present this as a few hooligans, a few marginal, you know, asocial types, who were criminal elements, and they acted like criminal elements. But this is a total misrepresentation of the historical facts. You had doctors and teachers and principals and pharmacists and priests, along with the other people who mm-hmm. participated. And this also explains why Lithuania had the highest rate of murdered Jews in the Holocaust, 96.4%. 212,000 out of 220,000 Jews who lived under the Nazi occupation of Lithuania were murdered. And a critical factor in that statistic is because of the massive help on the ground.
So aside from political opportunism and the perhaps the chance to curry favor with the Nazis and the fact that there was anti-Semitism there, is there lingering anti-Semitism there today? Would that
there
be
is,
part of the problem?
There is anti-Semitism there today, and it's interesting because in Eastern Europe today, the anti-Semitism that exists is the traditional anti-Semitism. In other words, in Western Europe and elsewhere, anti-Semitism today is linked to the Middle East conflict. It's the three major sources of anti-Semitism are Muslim communities, extreme left, and extreme right. But in Eastern Europe, aside from Russia, there are no Muslim communities, no appreciable Muslim communities. There's no extreme left. And what's left is extreme right. And it really links up with their fascist tendencies of the 20s and the 30s.
Still.
And it's what's ironic is that it's very often sparked by Holocaust-related issues, practical issues like prosecution of local killers and restitution. So whereas elsewhere in Europe, the memory of the Holocaust and the sensitivity to the Holocaust is a bulwark against the anti-Semitism, in Eastern Europe it's a source of anti-Semitism.
Hmm. Is that the same in other countries in the former Eastern Bloc, yeah. Poland, Romania, Estonia, yeah. those countries?
It is true to varying extents.
Before we started this conversation, you handed me several pieces of paper, which I have not had a chance to read, much less digest. But one of them is an update on Operation Last Chance. And at the top of the list is Lithuania. You launched the program there in 2002. If I'm reading this correctly, there were 199 suspects. Of them, 46 have been submitted to prosecution, and they are at the top of the list of Estonia, Latvia, Poland, Romania, Austria, Croatia, Hungary, Germany, and others. Germany comes in second. Well, no, it doesn't come in second. Excuse me. But anyway, they're at the top of the list, Lithuania. Is that a testimony to you and your efforts, or is it because you've been able to break through and through the conscience of these people and get them to cooperate?
It's because, first of all, the number of local collaborators was so large. But I have to say that the 46 names that I submitted to the local prosecutors have not led to a single prosecution. And the problem is that I can't prosecute a single person. I'm entirely mm-hmm. dependent on local prosecutors. And in Lithuania, there have been 3 trials of local Nazi war criminals since independence. Not a single one has sat 1 minute in jail. And the Lithuanian government did everything possible to make sure they would never be punished. And I'll give you an example. 2 of those people were very senior commanders in the Lithuanian security police, and they had run away to America, and in the United States, the Office of Special Investigations, which is the U.S. Justice Department's Nazi hunting arm, had stripped them of their American citizenship and kicked them out of the country, which is the maximum that the Americans can do. They arrived in Lithuania, and Lithuanians waited until they were medically unfit to stand trial, and then they charged them. So in other words, there was never any hope of them actually being punished. In the 3rd case, they actually sentenced someone to 5 years imprisonment, and the judges refused to implement the sentence mm-hmm. because they said that his wife was sick. Now, I would say that they're having sympathy for the yeah. people who least deserve any sympathy.
You bring up an interesting point. We sometimes hear from time to time about people being discovered in America as Nazi war criminals. Mm. At least they're accused of being Nazi war criminals, and they are extradited. That's your work.
Not necessarily. In other words, the United States government, what was once called the Office of Special Investigations, is doing a fabulous job. It's the best record in the world of any agency that deals with Nazi war criminals. And they have received an A grade from mm-hmm. us every single year that we're issuing our annual report.
Where do they go? Because if the most that we can do is deport them, where do we deport them? And then who handles them from there?
Okay. First of all, there were several cases of people whose extradition was sought by the governments of the country where they committed the crime. It was actually one of those people was actually executed mm-hmm. in Soviet Union, a man by the name of Fyodor Fedorenko, who was a guard at Treblinka. Most of the people are sent either to their country of origin or to the country from which they emigrated to the United States. But it's relatively rare that they'll be put on trial. Now, in the case of Lithuania, 15 of these people, at least 15, were kicked out. 14 returned to Lithuania. So in theory, Lithuania had a fantastic opportunity to put them on trial on criminal charges, because in the United States, it's a civil charge of lying on their immigration applications and later when they applied for citizenship.
Do we ask if you are you now or have you ever been a Nazi war criminal?
Yes. In other words, not in that exact language right. formulation, okay. but the questions, it clearly would show if the person was a Nazi war criminal.
Okay. So they lied and therefore we have the right to.
I jokingly call it the Al Capone compromise. In other words, they couldn't be prosecuted for the crimes themselves. So the American government luckily found a way of at least taking right. legal action against
because
him.
Because Al Capone, although he was a criminal, was gotten on tax evasion.
Tax evasion, right.
Operation Last Chance, which you launched, was a failure, you say, in Estonia, in part because of the Jewish community there.
That's correct.
Explain that.
Well, what happened was that whenever we launch Operation Last Chance in a country, we usually approach the Jewish community mm-hmm. and suggest that they be partners with us. And in Estonia, the Jewish community volunteered to monitor the information, to receive the information. But what happened was that all the information was lost, ostensibly. And I don't think it happened by accident. Hmm. My impression is that the community was very afraid that the project would arouse anti-Semitism. Now, we're aware of that. And we explained to them that it's true that it might arouse a little bit of anti-Semitism, but if these people are prosecuted by the local government, in the local language, by local judges, it's a very powerful statement against anti-Semitism, is the best way to defeat anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. So it's like an inoculation. You introduce a weakened form of the virus to protect the people from getting the real disease. Mm-hmm. But my sense is that they couldn't handle it.
This takes, I would guess, if you're in those countries, great courage to do this. But the lack of that courage, correct me if I'm wrong, is part of what got them into the Holocaust in the first place, because no one stood up to say, wait, stop.
Right.
You can't do this. And no one cried out to the world at large. Am I wrong or am I right?
No, you're right. And say, but in the case of the Jewish community, some of these communities are relatively small. Okay. And they could never pull off a thing like this by themselves.
Right.
So one of our goals is to empower them and to help them join in the effort to see that local Nazi collaborators who participated in mass murder are brought to justice.
You know, you would think that everybody would believe that in the 21st century, you and your efforts would have worldwide support. Obviously, that is not the case. Once again, these documents that you handed me like 2 minutes before you went on the air, I was shocked. I was just leafing through it, and I was shocked to find that Sweden is at the top of the list of not being cooperative. Canada doesn't cooperate. Australia doesn't cooperate.
Well, we have to distinguish between two different categories.
All right.
One category is those countries which, in principle, cannot prosecute Nazi war criminals. And I think many of our listeners will find this amazing, but the only two countries in the civilized world which, in principle, cannot prosecute Nazi war criminals are Sweden and Norway, which have a statute of limitations that applies even to genocide, mm-hmm. war crimes, mm-hmm. and crimes against humanity. That's almost unheard of in the civilized world. Now, Norway has finally changed its law and has dropped the statute of limitations, but didn't make it retroactive. So they still can't prosecute Nazis, and it's a country that had many Nazi collaborators. Mm-hmm. Quisling, the brand name of collaboration with the Nazis, was a Norwegian.
Is that why they made it not retroactive, because they're protecting their own?
I'm not sure. I hard for me to say. I'm not that well acquainted with the internal politics in Norway. And Sweden is the same thing. But countries like Canada, for example, is trying, in theory, to achieve results, but it's been a total failure. And what's interesting is that the geographic and biographic profile of the Nazi war criminals in Canada is exactly the same as the United States. And the Canadians apply the same system as in the United States of denaturalization and deportation. Mm-hmm. And whereas Canada has denaturalized 8 Nazi war criminals since 94, not a single one has been forced to leave Canada yet. Whereas the United States has won cases against 107 Nazi war criminals, mm-hmm. 75 have been stripped of their American citizenship, and over 50 deported. And it's a fantastic program. And part of the reason why the Americans are so successful is because they streamlined the appeal process, which once allowed 7 different appeals, and they reduced it to 3 to make it more manageable. And in Canada, they can't seem to get their act together.
Hmm. Every year, you rate countries according to their ability or their willingness or their track record.
The track record.
A, the only category, the top category, the only country in it is the United States. B is Germany, Italy, Serbia, and Spain. Poland gets a C. Canada, Denmark, and Netherlands get a D.
That's the last year. But this year, Germany, for the first time, got an A.
Okay.
And it's the first time that any other country ever received an A. And that's because Germany has changed its policy. And this is very interesting. They've become much more proactive in pursuing Nazi war criminals in the last 2 years. And we're seeing wonderful results. And they made 2 major changes in their prosecution policy. One is that they generally, until now, would never prosecute anyone except for officers. Hmm. But there were many people who were not officers, right, were out there doing the killing.
Well, in this year, as opposed to last year, Argentina has moved from the X category to the E category. What, right. are, the, what are those two categories?
Well, X means that they didn't even bother responding to the questionnaire. Okay. And this year, for the first time ever, they actually responded.
Because a lot of people went to Argentina, didn't they?
They did. And many very prominent Nazi war criminals and many Croatian Nazi war criminals. But at the moment, there are no active cases in Argentina. Mm-hmm. So that's what the E category
is. Can you explain why France, who were occupied by the Nazis in World War II, why they would not be, they wouldn't respond to you? They have not responded to you in the last two surveys.
Listen, a lot of people want to ignore us, to be perfectly honest. That's the sad reality.
Tell me how you find these people. I mean, it's been a long time. They've successfully hidden, some in plain sight, some not so, for 60 years. How do you find them? Let's go back. How do you decide who goes on the list?
Okay. There are three criteria for the list. One is command responsibility, if a person was an officer or not.
Mm-hmm.
Two was personal participation in murder. And three is the scope of the crime. So sometimes it's rather difficult.
So if you were just a guard at Treblinka and you just were a guard, are you on the list?
Oh, you're definitely on the list, and I'll explain to you why.
Okay.
Because, first of all, there was personal participation in murder.
Mm-hmm.
And the scope of the murder. There's 875,000 Jews were murdered in Treblinka. And it was 100 Ukrainians and Volksdeutsche Guards doing it and 20 Germans. So in other words, you divide those figures, each person had a role in tens of thousands of murders.
So this gets back to Nuremberg, where people said, I was only following orders. But is there not something to be said for that? I mean, what would have happened to these people if they said no?
Okay, first of all, there is not...
They would have been killed.
No, that's exactly the point.
Okay.
There is not a single documented case of a German who refused to participate in murder who was executed. Never happened. That's important.
It is important.
Okay. Now, in terms of non-Germans, it's a little more complicated. But the people who served at the Treblinka, Sobibor, and Belzec death camps, and we're mm-hmm. talking about camps where together about 1.8 million Jews were killed, they were mostly people who volunteered. They were Red Army soldiers who had been captured by the Nazis,
mm-hmm.
and they volunteered to serve in the SS. Now, it's true that the fate of Soviet POWs was harsh, but they didn't have to volunteer to serve for the SS. That was their choice. And these are people who actively participated, hands-on, in mass murder. That's why someone like Ivan Demyanyuk, even though he wasn't a officer, he served as a guard at the Sobibor death camp, was there from March till September 1943, during which time 29,000 Dutch Jews were murdered.
Mm-hmm.
He was high on our list.
How do you find these people?
Okay. We work the opposite of the police. In other words, the police start with a crime and then try and find who committed the crime. We don't have the time and the resources to do that. So we start with information. We start with allegations.
Tell you what, let's take a break. We'll come back and finish the answer to that question because we're coming up to a break, which I have to take on time. Dr. Ephraim Zuroff is our guest with the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Jerusalem. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is made possible in part today by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org. Coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, the creation of the world's first self-replicating synthetic cell heralds a new era in biology. It also prompts moral, legal, and safety questions. Today, an analysis of the potential benefits and ethical concerns of synthetic biology in about 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, do so. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or any other way imaginable, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. And we're coming right back.
I'm Jay Allison, producer of the Moth Radio Hour. Most radio is daily and disposable. Listen, forget, repeat. Not the Moth. I can pretty much guarantee you'll hear stories you'll never forget. Live storytelling for grown-ups on the Moth Radio Hour from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
The Moth returns Memorial Day weekend. Join us Sunday night at 6 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Ephraim Zuroff is with us, the director of the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Jerusalem, author of Operation Last Chance, One Man's Quest to Bring Nazi Criminals to Justice. He's in town tonight to speak at 8. He's town today to speak tonight at 8 at the Jewish Community Center. We have some questions that are standing by on the phone and on email. But first, let's go back to the question we were talking about, and that is how you find these people after all these years.
So this was, of course, one of the reasons why we launched Operation Last Chance, to find out about Nazis we were not aware of. And our project has yielded names of 560 suspects.
Okay.
And I invite our listeners to visit our website. The address is www.operationlastchance.org. Mm-hmm. And follow our progress. So once we get an allegation, we have to check three things. First of all, is it credible? You have no idea how many people have called me after a squabble with their neighbors telling me that their neighbor has a German accent, he's 87 years old, he must be a Nazi war criminal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but that's ridiculous, of course. Okay, so the allegation has to be credible, the person has to be alive and healthy enough to stand trial, and he or she, and some of them are women, by the way, cannot have already been prosecuted for that crime. And then we have to...
Why? Because you don't believe double jeopardy?
Double jeopardy, yeah. So then we have to see if we can corroborate the allegation. Mm-hmm. In other words, we do the research. And I say jokingly or half-jokingly, I'm the third detective, the third historian, and the third political lobbyist.
Mm-hmm.
Detective to find the person, historian to find the evidence, and lobbyist, very often, the problem is not the lack of a good case, but the fact that the government or the country, either that sent him or that... where he or she committed their crime, doesn't want to bring them to justice.
Right. Is documentation something that's relatively easy to do, given the way that the Nazi Germans kept records? They kept meticulous records of everything.
Okay, there aren't documents for every single murder, of course, but there's no question that we're the beneficiaries of the enormous documentation produced by the Nazis. On the other hand, the Nazis, for example, destroyed the SS archives. Before the fall of Berlin, and they made efforts to hide the crime of the Final Solution. Mm-hmm. So we have some documents, we don't have all documents, and the documents are very helpful, but they don't cover everything.
And given the age of the people we're talking about here, it would also seem that many of the witnesses to their crimes, their alleged crimes, are also dwindling.
Right.
How difficult is it to find witnesses?
It is difficult, but not impossible. So, for example, I'll give you a story. We have this Chandra Kapiro, one of the officers who organized the mass murder of at least 1,300 civilians, mostly Jews, but also Serbs and Gypsies, in the city of Novi Sad in Serbia. And he and his men rounded up thousands of local residents, many of whom were taken to the banks of the Danube to be shot.
Right.
And among those people were children and teenagers. And we were able to find some of those people who will hopefully testify at his trial, which we hope will take place.
How many? You mentioned that some of the people that you've gone after are women. How many?
A very small percentage. We had a very important case about 3 years ago of a woman named Erna Valisch, who was a guard at the Ravensbrück and the Majdanek concentration camp. And we were able to get the Austrians to open up an investigation. And here we encountered something that, for me, was absolutely horrifying. This woman had admitted that she took people to the gas chambers to be murdered. Mm-hmm. She had guarded them so they couldn't escape. There's also some evidence of her acting in a cruel way. The Austrian authorities told me that she can't be prosecuted because what she had done was considered passive complicity in genocide. Okay, now, let's analyze that term, genocide. We all know what that is.
Right.
Complicity, we also know what that is. What's passive complicity in genocide? So, to make a long story short, under Austrian law, that was prescribed by a statute of limitations.
Right.
Now, I I was infuriated by this. And I went to the Polish authorities and I begged them to help us or to work to try and find survivors who could testify against Erna Wallach. And they found five testimonies. And one of the interesting things about the case was she had gotten pregnant in Majdanek. And that was one of the reasons people remembered her. And then ultimately she was transferred because of that. Mm-hmm. And the Austrians were forced to reopen the case. But unfortunately, totally unexpectedly, she died before she could be prosecuted.
Once you find these people, you don't have the power to arrest them or to prosecute them.
No power whatsoever.
So what is your process for bringing these people to justice?
Okay, we have no choice but to turn them over, turn the cases over to the local prosecutors and to try and assist them to the best of our ability if they want our assistance. In some cases, they don't want our assistance. They don't want our involvement at all. In other cases, they're happy to work together with us. Mm-hmm. So it's done on a country-by-country basis. Each country is a little different in that regard.
I have more questions about this, but I want to also let people join the conversation. So if you put your headphones on, we'll take a couple of phone calls very quickly here, and we'll begin with Tony in Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Yes, Mike. Great show. Doctor, back in 1992, I was a broadcast director, and we were following the case of a man named John Damjanyuk, who allegedly had been Ivan the Terrible. And I since retired, and we lost track of the case. But I was wondering if you could comment on how that case ever ended up.
Okay. Originally, Ivan Damjanyuk was stripped of his American citizenship and was scheduled to be deported from the United States. But Israel asked for his extradition on the charges that he was Ivan the Terrible, the person who had ran the gas chambers at the notorious Treblinka death camp. And initially he was convicted and he was sentenced to death, but during the course of his appeal in Israel, it became clear that there was serious doubt as to his identity as that Ivan the Terrible person who had run the gas chambers. And as a result, he was convicted only for membership in a Nazi organization, and the punishment for that was 7 years in prison. And he had already served the 7 years. So Israel expelled him, and he went back to the United States. But the United States later again prosecuted him, not for Treblinka, but for service in the Sobibor death camp, which is a death camp in Poland where 250,000 Jews were murdered. And he served there from March till September 1943, during which time 29,000 Dutch Jews were murdered. And there was testimony that he had was an active participant in that process. And on that basis, he was extradited to Germany and is actually currently in court in Munich to answer those charges.
Okay. Thank you for your call. Let's go to Tom in York.
Good morning. I'd like to ask the gentleman, earlier in the show, you said that you kind of expected that some of these people would say that they were brainwashed, they were indoctrinated, they were young, they were stupid. As a defense, and say they were sorry, but none of them said they were sorry. Can you talk a little bit about what happens to young children who are brainwashed in such a way that it becomes so much part of their person that they don't see wrong, they think it's right, and relate that to some groups that we see today that preach hate against others, and the people growing up in those groups, young people growing up in those groups, assimilate the hate and don't see that it's wrong?
Well, I think the problems are similar. In other words, when we're talking about people who espouse hate and have no tolerance for the other, it's a similar situation. And the problem during World War II was that the geopolitical circumstances created by Nazi Germany encouraged these people to take action together with Nazi Germany and Germans and Austrians and Nazis themselves in the most violent way imaginable to carry out a plan, a diabolical plan for the total elimination of all the Jews. But it wasn't only Jews, of course, who were the victims of the Nazis. The Nazis also murdered homosexuals. They murdered Jehovah's Witnesses. They murdered Polish intelligentsia and others. And the result of this hatred was the mass murder carried out by the Nazis in World War II. So those ideas are unfortunately still alive now in certain groups. Thank God they're relatively marginal, but I think we always have to be vigilant to guard society against haters like this.
I know that you've been involved in helping Rwanda in prosecuting those who were involved in the genocide there. Aside from Rwanda, are there other groups, other nations, other political, organizations that are doing something similar or would do something similar to what happened in the Holocaust if they have the opportunity?
Well, I think we saw something somewhat similar in Darfur. In other words, the situation there was not the same as the Holocaust, but the result was hundreds of thousands of people murdered there as a result of a political conflict and ethnic differences and the like. And the question is, how does the world respond to these cases? The United Nations was created partially because of the Holocaust. A very strong element of its creation was to prevent future Holocausts, prevent future genocides. Right. In that respect, unfortunately, it's been a dismal failure.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, Tom, but I know that you're a frequent caller to this program and you're a frequent caller when it comes to the topic of religion.
Right.
So I'm going to ask you if you have veiled your question, if you really want to know what role certain religious organizations play in creating this kind of indoctrination. Is that true? Is that what you're trying to say?
Mike, you're exactly right.
Thank you. I thought I was.
Look at today. Well, you don't have to look past what's going on. We have teabaggers with guns. We have people calling our president a Nazi. We have people spreading hate. We have skinheads in this country, neo-Nazis. You can see it on the Discovery Channel programs that go on about what we have going on here. We have people who perceive themselves as good, God-fearing people. Was the Ku Klux Klan was obviously inspired by God, they said. Mm. I mean, we don't have to look very far, and they're seconds away from picking up their guns and going into the street and trying to kill the people that they hate.
Are there parallels here that concern you, or is it drawing a line that's too deep in the sand?
No, I think that there are certain parallels among all haters. And the question, of course, is the ability of people who are motivated by this hate for the other to implement their plans. And this is obviously a danger. But
because those of us who watch, whose only exposure to Kristallnacht and the persecution of Jews in Germany and the concentration camps is the movies. For most people it is. It's their only exposure to it, the movies and television. So we see these people as evil. The people living through those times did not necessarily see themselves and probably didn't see themselves as evil.
You're right. Listen, this was precisely the problem in a country like Nazi Germany, where Adolf Hitler was elected in a regular election to be the Chancellor of Germany. And ultimately, he was able to garner the support of the overwhelming majority of the German population. And later, he had the support of the population in Austria. And it was this support which enabled him to implement his program of mass violence.
Thank you for your call, Tom. Ellie in Charlotte writes, as I listened to your program this morning, I began thinking about The Pity of It All by Amos Elon. It is a study of the history of the Jews in Germany, beginning with the entrance of Felix Mendelssohn's grandfather into Berlin after he paid a tax equivalent to that of bringing a sow into the city. It culminates with Kristallnacht in 1933. When I read it, I was struck by the similarities of those old German laws that dealt with the treatment of Jews and those of the southern U.S. that promulgated the Jim Crow era. Perhaps the lack of remorse exhibited by the Nazi criminals has its roots in German history. It is uncertain that many Germans saw nothing wrong with the actions of Hitler and his minions. It is also worth noting that almost every European nation at one time or another has expelled all Jews from its borders or has conducted pogroms against them. Horrendous as it was, Hitler's program was merely the largest and longest in a long history of them.
Well, it's not exactly historically accurate, but in other words, the introduction of racism into anti-Semitism, racism based on a person's birth with no possibility of, you know, escape, was a unique feature of the Holocaust. Also, the industrialized mass annihilation was, in a sense, unique.
Matt in Charlotte writes, I had enjoyed hearing you speak about the terrible, terrible tragedy of the Holocaust and the Lithuanians' role then and now. My great-grandfather was one of the founding fathers of Lithuania, Jonas, and I can't pronounce it, Vailokaitis, is that close? I would be very interested in talking with you further about how we can use my great-grandfather's clout and influence to bring these criminals to justice. We can give you that email if you'd like it later on. Ben in Charlotte, and this is inevitable, the Jews celebrate and worship their own invented history of successful genocides, killing off the men, women, and children who previously occupied the Promised Land. Israel today excludes native persons from voting based solely on race. Your guest's investigations are race-based and personally motivated. He is clearly uninterested in modern war crimes, say, torture under Bush. Your guest should answer for the hypocrisy of celebrating genocide and or benefiting from historical genocides whilst continuing this victim narrative for political exploitation.
Full of lies and propaganda. Listen, anyone who knows the situation in Israel knows that Israel's Arab citizens have the full right to vote. They serve in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. So this is utter rubbish.
Okay. What do you view as your greatest achievement after all these years of working?
I would divide it into two. I think that in practical terms, judicial terms, my biggest achievement was helping to bring Dinko Šakić to trial, the commandant of Jasenovac. But in larger historical terms, it was illuminating the very important role played by non-Germans and Austrians in the mass annihilation of the Jewish people during the Holocaust.
And with that, we'll have to leave it. Dr. Ephraim Zuroff, historian, director of the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Jerusalem, and author of Operation Last Chance, One Man's Quest to Bring Nazi Criminals to Justice. He's here under the auspices of the of Congregation Ora Torah and the Jewish Federation of Greater Charlotte. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you. It was wonderful.